This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you live for this broadcast on this snowy Saturday morning here in Connecticut. As many of you know, for the past 5 weeks, we've been doing taped programs as I have been in Florida working for actually two of my employers, the New York Yankees, as well as the UConn women's basketball team. And it was great the way that coincided and a great result. We're going to be back to having live questions today. So if you have questions for me or my guest, you can reach out at info@alessimd.com. My guest today is going to be Dr. Lisa Knopf. Dr. Knopf is Associate Director for Epilepsy Surgery at the Eyer Neuroscience Institute at Hartford Healthcare. She is a boarded neurologist, and she is a specialist in seizures and epilepsy. So we're going to be talking quite a bit about epilepsy, the history of it, the treatment of it, and really, more importantly, I really want to get to the use of surgery to go out and correct epilepsy. So I think this is a fascinating field. It's fascinating even among neurologists and neurosurgeons on how this is done. It's time to bring you up to date. I've spent several segments really talking about the measles outbreak, of which we have no control over. Right now, Robert F. Kennedy is the top public health official in this country. His job is pretty simple. It's to keep us healthy, whether it be by promoting good health or keeping us from dying of diseases. So far, in the first 90 days of his regime, he has failed. He has failed miserably. And let's talk about why. Right now, we are dealing with a measles outbreak in six states. Indiana has now joined Texas, New Mexico, Indiana, Kansas, Ohio, and Oklahoma. We have 700 cases reported. 541 of those cases are in Texas alone. And it's because people have not been vaccinated, especially in a community, a Mennonite community. And let me just go out to say the Mennonite religion has said they are not against vaccination. But this community has decided vaccines are bad, and they have fallen prey to charlatans. And we'll talk a little bit about who those people are, because we're going to name them. We're going to name them, because it's about time we start naming these criminals. Let's talk a little bit about measles. Measles is a viral illness. Measles is something for which we have had a vaccine since 1990. And we have wiped this disease off the United States in 2000. It's now back because people have believed the fallacy that vaccines are bad and the MMR vaccine causes autism, something that's been proven time and time again. So now we're dealing with this outbreak. Since the beginning of this year, we have had more cases than any full year since 1992. And we're only 3 months into this. We've had two deaths in unvaccinated children, another death in an unvaccinated adult. Seeing a pattern here? the length of the outbreak keeps getting extended by 2 weeks for each time a new case is reported. Epidemiologists are suspecting that this is going to last the rest of the year and maybe for another full year just because of the pattern. This is science, okay? And that is what we're dealing with here. These outbreaks in other states, an outbreak is determined whenever you have three or more cases. The measles virus is among the most virulent viruses we deal with. Why? Because it can live on a surface for hours. It can be transmitted by surface and by air. And the people who have it are contagious for 4 days before they have a rash and 4 days after the rash. Please remember those numbers because we're going to get back to those. 4 days before the rash, 4 days after the rash, you are now virulent. And we know that the vaccine works. But Mr. Kennedy has refused to acknowledge that until this past week. He didn't look into a camera and say, the vaccine is the best treatment. He decided to put a tweet up on X, okay? Vaccination is the best way to prevent the spread of disease. With that, you would think that's pretty definitive. But no, he then scrambles a little bit and goes on to praise two extraordinary healers who have treated and healed some 300 measles-stricken Mennonite children using aerosolized budesonide and clarithromycin. Now, listeners to this program are pretty smart. I'm very proud of the people who typically listen to this show because you know that an antibiotic does not kill a virus. And an oral steroid is not the treatment. So who's saying this? Well, there are two doctors, one of which was penalized, and I don't know, he may have lost his license in Texas, but is back out there. But I want to focus on one of them. This is Dr. Ben Edwards. Dr. Edwards is out there in West Texas treating children with inhaled steroids that he previously said, he is well known, he thinks oral steroids were the treatment for COVID. Well, it didn't work there, so he decided we would try this for measles. So he's out there touting this, and the top public health official in our country is praising this. Now, this story even gets better, okay? Because there's an interview that I saw with Dr. Edwards, and he has measles. He's got the rash on his face, and he admits to having measles. When he was vaccinated, it was when he got the weakened vaccine. But even getting the weakened vaccine, okay, well, even when you get that, your symptoms are not going to be as bad, but you're just as contagious. So this interview takes place where he actually shows the rash on his face, knowing he is contagious with measles, and he is treating and evaluating children right there in the scene who are not vaccinated. Now, many of you remember the historical figure of Typhoid Mary, right? Typhoid Mary, Mary Mallon, was someone who came to this country from Ireland, and she's infamous because she carried typhoid. Typhoid was a bacterial infection. It's related to, it's a salmonella infection. And she was working preparing food for families. And these people would come down with typhoid. Finally, they traced it back to her, and she was quarantined for a lengthy period of time. There was no treatment for it. She was continuing to spread it. Finally, years after she was quarantined, they appeared to appeal to the courts in Manhattan, and she agreed that she would never work preparing food again. And they let her go, knowing that she had the virus. So what does she do? She gets a job preparing food again. And this time, it was actually in Canada. This is someone who knowingly has an infectious disease and knows that they're going to spread it to vulnerable people and does this knowingly. That's called assault. Dr. Ben Edwards has not only violated his oath to uphold health and take care of people, but he is a criminal. And I say that in the strongest terms. And Robert F. Kennedy has also proven to be complicit in this. How did he get his job? Is he a scientist? Did he do something? No. He decided to take the oath and join the Trump regime and bring his voters over there so he gets rewarded to be the top public health official. I don't mind you making him an ambassador, okay, or some other lackey job, okay? That's politics. That's business. But putting this man in charge is an absolute disservice and an assault on the American people. And I haven't even gotten to autism yet. This day in medicine, Dr. Marshall Hall in 1856 first described artificial respiration. Again, these are great science, these are great thinkers. He came up with a form of CPR that saved people's lives. Also, in 1837, he was the first to describe the reflex arc. Right? When a doctor taps on your knees and you see that reflex, right? He was the first one to describe that in 1837. So again, we remember Dr. Marshall Hall, who lived from 1790 to 1857. We're going to take a short break. They're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Lisa Knopf. We're going to be talking about epilepsy, treatment of epilepsy, and epilepsy surgery. So if you have questions for me, just reach out. We'll ask her live at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it gives me a great pleasure to welcome my guest today, Dr. Lisa Knopf. Dr. Knopf is Associate Director of Epilepsy Surgery at the Eye Neuroscience Institute at Hartford Hospital. And she is a board-certified neurologist with a subspecialty in epilepsy. Lisa, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start. I've talked about your credentials, but talk to us a little bit about your background and really what made you go into neurology and what attracted you to the study of epilepsy.
Yes. Yeah, so, I was born in Connecticut at Hartford Hospital, the same place where I'm working now. As an undergrad, I went to Amherst College, where I was a psychology major, but I always had an interest and a plan to go to medical school. And at the time, I thought I was going to be a psychiatrist. But through some of my research after undergrad and then during medical school, the field of neurology started to stand out to me as something more interesting, more fascinating. The brain is one of the only organs that can talk to you about itself. It's still mysterious to us in a lot of ways, but even in my fairly short career since coming out of fellowship, there have been an incredible number of developments. So a lot of treatments that didn't used to exist now can, now do, and it's just been a big ride. So that's sort of the intellectual side. I got interested in epilepsy based on a few things. When I was, even before medical school, I actually had a roommate with epilepsy who would periodically have seizures. I had to learn how to administer first aid to her during her seizures. And so it was, it was very scary the first time I saw it, but it became empowering to learn that this is a treatable condition. I watched her go through monitoring at Johns Hopkins and the epilepsy monitoring unit to get a better therapy and watch her seizures get under better control. And so that was really cool. And, kind of exposed me to something I had no idea existed. I also had a close family member with a minor but disfiguring neurological condition called Bell's palsy that they experienced when I was a younger child. And I watched them get treated by a neurologist in the local area. And even though Bell's palsy is curable or can, you know, not usually goes away on its own over time, it doesn't always do so. And I saw the way that neurologists can help patients understand their condition, understand that even if they can't get better completely, there are a lot of sort of palliative treatments to help you feel better. And so I just, between all of those things, I felt like it was a good fit for me.
That's so interesting, especially about your roommate. But let's talk a little bit about seizures. And what are seizures? Epileptic seizures, non-epileptic seizures? Can you give somebody a brief overview?
Of course. So let's start with epileptic seizures. So I tell patients that an epileptic seizure is a burst of abnormal electrical activity in the brain, or think of it as a power surge or an electrical storm in the brain. So it can temporarily disrupt how the brain normally works. And depending on where in your brain the electrical storm is happening, a seizure might cause you to have different symptoms. So it might cause you to temporarily space out, blank out, lose awareness. It could cause you to shake or stiffen, which is often the way seizures are portrayed on TV in the media. You may stare blankly. You might feel strange sensations, like you might have a deja vu, unusual smells or tingling. So that's an epileptic seizure. Now, I'll talk about epilepsy next. So I've just described a seizure. Epilepsy is a condition where you have repeated, unprovoked seizures, so not just one. And when I say unprovoked, I mean that the seizure isn't caused by something external or temporary, like low blood sugar, alcohol withdrawal, or a high fever. So it's a chronic brain condition. You've had at least two in order to meet that criteria. Doesn't mean you're having seizures all the time. People with epilepsy can go long stretches, like months or even years, or even lifetimes without additional seizures if they are appropriately treated. And so that's epilepsy. Now, non-epileptic seizures, the terminology for that has evolved over the years. And now what we call them are psychogenic non-epileptic events. We're trying to take the word seizure out of the definition altogether. These are frequently misunderstood in the media. These are episodes that can look a lot like seizures to an inexperienced observer and are often mistaken as such, even when a patient shows up in the ER with the symptoms, but they're not caused by that power surge of abnormal electrical activity. They are actually a type of conversion disorder, which means that they are a physical manifestation of a psychological problem. People with histories of psychological conditions, especially things like PTSD and trauma, are very vulnerable to developing non-epileptic events. And actually, about a third of the people who I take care of in the inpatient epilepsy unit leave with this diagnosis. So non-epileptic events look a lot like epileptic seizures, can be treated inappropriately as epileptic seizures, and are a big population that we see in order to tease out and get an appropriate diagnosis and treatment for.
Are those patients typically referred to psychiatry for treatment?
Yes. So once you have a diagnosis, the next step is to get them therapy or psychiatry. Talk therapy is the mainstay of management, and meds can be supplemental and helpful for managing the symptoms, but epilepsy doctors are not trained in the management. In our clinic at Hartford Healthcare, we have a wonderful social worker who has some training in therapy for treatment of psychogenic non-epileptic events, and Sometimes she does actually do a little bit of the treatment, and she'll also sometimes speak with patients' existing therapists to talk about different treatment strategies, since it's really not that well known or understood in the psychology community.
Sure, sure. Listen, and I'm glad you made the distinction that if someone has a seizure, doesn't mean they have epilepsy and having an isolated event. I think that's such an important point for everybody to hear. We're going to take a short break. Now we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Lisa Kanoff, and we're discussing epilepsy. So if you have questions, get them to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. My guest today is Dr. Lisa Kanoff, and she is a specialist in epilepsy. She is a neurologist. For those of you interested and would like to reach out to Dr. Kanoff at her clinic, the phone number is 860-972-3600. Lisa, we were talking a little bit about differences between seizures and epilepsy, but how many people in the United States are affected by epilepsy? I've never really looked into
Great
this.
Question. So epilepsy affects about 1 in 26 people in the United States. So that number's in the millions. Wow. That's more than many better known conditions like Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis. It's extremely common. On top of that, about 1 in 10 people in the United States and in the world will have at least one seizure in their lifetime. Doesn't mean they have epilepsy, but 1 in 10 of us may have a seizure. So quite a common condition.
I have a question that just came in from Pat, and that is apropos to your experience with your roommate. If you witness somebody having a seizure, what should you do for that person? How can you help them?
It's a wonderful question and something that we talk about with every newly diagnosed patient. So the most important thing you can do for somebody having a seizure is to keep them safe. And it's actually pretty simple. One myth is that people could bite or swallow, or that people could swallow their tongue during a seizure. That's kind of an old wives' tale that's been popularized. People used to think that you should put something in their mouth to keep them from doing that. Don't do that. Keep them safe. So if you are able and it's safe to gently lower them to the ground during a seizure, do that. Sometimes they're convulsing and they fall on their own, and that just happens. Once they're on the ground, try to move anything away from them in their environment that they could injure themselves on. If you're able to get in there and loosen any tight clothing that could be constricting their breathing, do that. Don't try and stop them from shaking or convulsing. It won't stop the convulsion. That shaking itself stops on its own, usually after a minute or two. If you have the wherewithal, and it can be hard because watching a seizure is scary, try and time the seizure. As I said, they usually stop after a minute or two, but if you're timing it and you know that it's lasting longer than that, specifically if that shaking part goes on then longer than 5 minutes, that means that it's appropriate to call 911. That's sort of the safety measures during a seizure. When the seizure ends, and I'm talking about, your typical generalized convulsion, or what we used to call a grand mal seizure, sometimes afterwards people will be very confused. They may be lethargic. Occasionally they will be throwing up. And so you want to try and turn them on their side if you can and stay with them as they gradually wake up and come back to themselves. Again, people with a known diagnosis of epilepsy don't have to go to the emergency room for every seizure, and that's sort of individualized to the person. If it's a first seizure, you're going to want to call 911 to have them taken to an ER and be assessed. So the big things are really to keep them safe as best you can without putting yourself in harm's way or putting them in harm's way by putting anything in their mouth.
Lisa,
great
what
question.
About you talked a little bit about generalized seizure, but what other seizure types are there? You know, we used to always talk mm-hmm. about, many people still use the term petit mal seizures. Can you talk a little bit about the different types of seizures and how they're manifested, what you see in a person who's having these events?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And like I said, we, in the epilepsy world, we just love to change our terminology. It seems like once every 5 years, there's a new word for seizures. Yeah. So what we used to call petit mal seizures, then we started calling complex partial seizures. And now since 2017, the term from them is focal seizures or focal epilepsy. So focal epilepsy is the most common kind in adults. And this is epilepsy where seizures start in one specific part of the brain, okay? Now, the seizures can cause a wide range of symptoms depending on where in the brain that they start. So the symptoms could be confusion, loss of awareness, unusual movements, things like lip smacking or repetitive movements of the hands, or subtle emotional changes. Sometimes people are totally awake during the seizure, and we call those focal aware seizures. And sometimes they lose awareness, and that's what we call a focal impaired aware seizure. And then that focal seizure can progress to a grand mal, or now what we call a bilateral tonic-clonic seizure. But that focal part is the key. It's starting in one place. Generalized epilepsy is your second group, and this is where the seizures seem to involve both sides of the brain from the start. Possibly due to generation from a deep part of the brain called the thalamus, although we're still honing our understanding of the pathophysiology of generalized epilepsy. So generalized epilepsy can cause a more kind of limited number of seizure types. They might look like full, you know, generalized tonic-clonic seizures, or they might be more subtle seizures like absence seizures, where somebody might stare off for a few seconds and not respond. Another type is myoclonic seizures, where people might have jerking, frequent, repetitive, violent jerking movements of their arms and or their legs. And generalized epilepsy tends to be more commonly diagnosed in children, although occasionally it can come on in adolescence or adulthood. But focal is really what I'm most commonly seeing in my adult epilepsy clinic. Now, some people can have combined types where they have both focal and generalized seizures. This is a lot less common. And then there's also some epilepsy syndromes that are diagnosed based on people's age, their seizure type, and their EEG patterns. Things like juvenile myoclonic epilepsy or childhood absence epilepsy, but that's a little bit beyond the scope of our discussion. Go ahead. No, I was just going to say that that's a big part of my assessment when I'm meeting and diagnosing a patient is determining, well, is this a seizure? Is it epilepsy? If it's epilepsy, is it focal or generalized? Because knowing the type of epilepsy helps us choose and tailor the treatment. It's not one size fits all. The choice of medication is tailored to whether it's focal or generalized. And in general, our goal here is to tailor the treatment to the individual.
Well, it's interesting because you got to my next question is, you mm-hmm. know, how to make the diagnosis. So when someone shows up in your clinic, how are you going about making this diagnosis of epilepsy? You know, I think you already got into a little bit of that. So somebody shows up to see you. What's the process?
Great question. So the biggest part of that first appointment is getting to know each other and taking a detailed history and doing a neurological exam. So the history is really critical in this appointment. I need to understand what happened before, during, and after that seizure. Now, often people don't remember their seizures. Remember how I said you can have impaired awareness during your seizures, and often people are amnestic, meaning they don't remember what happened afterwards. So it's super helpful to have a witness or a family member either come to the appointment or joined by phone or even just provide some information to the patient beforehand so we have a good description of what they saw. If they come with a video, I am incredibly thankful. That's unusual, but a video is really the gold standard. So we want that history, and we want a detailed description of the before, during, and the after. Now, from there, if I suspect seizure, and in the vast majority of my consults, I do, or I have some other ideas on my differential, I'm going to order two key tests. The first would be an EEG, which stands for electroencephalogram, which is a brainwave test, similar to an EKG, which more people are familiar with, where you put electrodes throughout the scalp and look at the brain's electrical activity. We're looking for patterns, which we call epileptiform discharges, which are kind of like those sparks that can cause the electrical storm that's a seizure, and those suggest a tendency to have seizures. So EEG is test number one. The second test is brain imaging, and almost always that means an MRI, and that's to look for any physical abnormalities like a scar, a lesion, or a structural abnormality that could be triggering the seizures. So we almost universally get those two tests. Now, a seizure or epilepsy is a clinical diagnosis, so a normal EEG or a normal MRI don't necessarily mean you didn't have a seizure or you don't have epilepsy. They're important as secondary backup data, so we always do it, but at the end of the day, it really comes down to that history, and that's, to me, what makes it so interesting as a neurologist.
Quick question that just came in from Pat is, I have a child who had febrile seizures. Should those have been treated, or what is the approach to febrile seizures, I think, is what she's getting at?
This is a very good question, and I'll give you the caveat that I am not a pediatric neurologist, so my knowledge in this area isn't as up to date, but I will tell you that many children have febrile seizures, and if they're brief, those are called simple febrile seizures. Often they're limited. Most of the time they're a limited condition. You'll have one or two, and you'll never go on to develop seizures as an adult or to develop epilepsy. A complex febrile seizure is one that's very prolonged, I think it's really the duration that makes them complex, and that's associated with a higher risk for going on to develop epilepsy. So you have to make that distinction. Usually these resolve on their own. Like I said, you treat the cause of the fever, right? Whether it was, influenza or a viral illness. Sometimes antipyretic medications like Tylenol are given, and usually no seizure medications are prescribed. So vast majority of the time, really no treatment is needed unless there's a complex febrile seizure or after the febrile illness is over and seizures continue, then treatment is indicated. So I hope that kind of answers the question.
Oh, I think it absolutely does. So let's talk a little bit about get into treatment and the
sure.
various medications that you might use for the treatment of epilepsy. And I know this is such a changing field. Historically, certainly. So can you talk a little bit about the treatment?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's just been an explosion in different treatments for epilepsy over the past 30 years, and it's changing every day. So the first medications for seizures actually came out in the 1920s and 30s, and some of them are actually still used, like phenobarbital. I still have some patients who are on it. Up until the 80s or 90s, there were only about four drugs available to treat epilepsy, and they were effective but strong and had a lot of side effects. Starting in the 90s, tons of new meds came out on the market. Now we have over 26 different drugs that are FDA approved to treat epilepsy. The newer drugs are awesome in that they have fewer side effects, fewer risks for damage to the liver, kidneys, and the bones, and the brain. But interestingly, with the exception of one of the newest medications on the market, they all seem to have similar effectiveness in actually stopping seizures. So we have a ton of meds, but and they're getting more and more safe, but they all have similar efficacy. So drugs are the mainstay, okay? We try to match the right drug to your seizure type and to your age, to your other health conditions, or what we call comorbidity, as well as your lifestyle. We also keep in mind just pricing, and just like the pragmatic side of things, wanting to make sure you're on something that's covered by insurance and is appropriate. And that's step one. If you're still seizing, you continue to have seizures despite one medication, we might then switch you to a second medication or add a second medication and go from there. If you keep having seizures despite being on two appropriately dosed medications for an appropriate amount of time, that's what we call drug-resistant epilepsy, or epilepsy that can't necessarily be completely treated with medications alone. So at that point, we start talking about candidacy for other options, and that includes surgery for epilepsy. And this is always a little bit of a scary topic when it comes up for the first time in the doctor's office, and a big part of my job is to demystify it for people. So surgery for epilepsy can include a resective surgery, which is where a neurosurgeon actually goes in and removes the part of the brain where the seizure is coming from. And that's done after extensive testing to make sure this can be done safely so that it doesn't cause a risk for a personality change or loss of memory or crucial brain functions. And then more recently, neuromodulation devices or pacemakers for the brain are another option for people who aren't candidates for that type of resective brain surgery. And that could include devices like the vagus nerve stimulator, the responsive neural stimulator, aka the NeuroPace, as well as deep brain stimulation, which was originally developed to treat Parkinson's disease, but it's now also used in epilepsy. And then the last treatment that is also used for specific populations is a special type of diet called the ketogenic diet, which is a very restrictive diet consisting mostly of fat and a little bit of protein. And that's typically used as a supplement to medication for very specific types of epilepsy. So really the take-home point is that we have more tools than ever to treat epilepsy, and it's not just limited to drugs. And with the right treatment plan, I've seen many people go on to live full, active lives where seizures are not defining their day-to-day existence. And it's just been really awesome to experience the developments in the field in the past 20 years.
Let me go over a couple of things that you mentioned. First of all, the ketogenic diet. We used to think about that only in children as a treatment for epilepsy. So you're saying that the ketogenic diet also helps for adults with epilepsy?
That's right. Yeah. So ketogenic diet was first discovered, I want to say, probably in the 1930s. It was actually originally kind of anecdotally just noticed that when children were kind of, for lack of better words, starved or not being fed, that their seizure frequency was lessening. So then at Johns Hopkins in the 30s and 40s, they began to research this and discovered that indeed with specific high fat, extremely low protein and almost zero carb diets, seizures could get a lot better. And yes, traditionally, it's been used more in children. But in my practice, and really most practices, we find that it works for adults as well. It tends to be used more in those generalized epilepsies as opposed to focal epilepsies. So that narrows the scope a little bit. And remember how I said generalized epilepsies are more common in kids. And so that's why, again, kids are on it more often. But I have patients with conditions like Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, a type of epilepsy, a generalized epilepsy, who benefit a lot from ketogenic diet. Now, it's a tough one to follow. It's really high fat. It's not a fun diet, and there's some modified options out there now. There's the modified Atkins diet, which allows for a little bit more protein and a little bit of carbohydrates, as well as the low glycemic index diet, which is even a little bit more permissive, which can still help and are a little bit more manageable for people. But,
and I'm assuming that the diet is in addition to medication. You're not just treating it with diet.
Correct. Yeah, I would not recommend that.
Okay.
I perhaps have one patient who's only on the ketogenic diet due to complete inability to tolerate meds, but it's really not recommended to do it on its own.
Another question, and something you touched on, Pat sent me a text that she's been on phenobarbital since childhood and has not had a seizure in many years, but has always been afraid to come off of the medication since it hasn't really affected her. I guess I come up against this occasionally, and you know, is there any harm in doing that?
It's such a good question, and it's a tough question, and it's a common thing I encounter with new patients. You start on a medication as a kid, and when is it meant to be stopped? Are you seizure-free because the medication's working, or because your epilepsy has gone into remission and you're better, right? And to be honest, the state of the literature and the research and the guidelines are still not totally clear on this. We know that the longer you go without a seizure, the greater the likelihood of long-term seizure freedom. So, you know, if you had seizures during childhood and you haven't had them for 20 or 30 years, the likelihood of seizure freedom coming off medications is higher, but it's not zero. The type of epilepsy that you have is also relevant here. And we don't always know what type of epilepsy you had as a kid. We are working with incomplete information. Often folks come in saying, you know, I had a seizure when I was a kid. Nobody who witnessed it is still living to say if it was a focal or generalized seizure. And I don't know if I had childhood absence epilepsy. So we deal with that. But if it was generalized epilepsy, that is more likely to go into remission in adulthood compared to focal. So what I will do is I'll get that history. I often get some ancillary testing like that EEG and that MRI, although actually an EEG that still has epileptiform abnormalities on it doesn't mean that stopping meds is off the table for you. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go on to have more seizures. So there's no, you know, magic bullet to get an answer. Still in my practice, I tend to get these tests. And then a lot of the decision from there is really individualized, right? So somebody who drives a lot for personal reasons, for work, may not want to take that risk of coming off medication. So someone who lives alone might feel the same way. And so that's where that one-on-one conversation about goals and risk tolerance comes in. And then, you know, phenobarbital, that's a common one that folks come in having been on for years, because like I said, it's one of those early meds that was one of those four drugs that were available 40 years ago. And it is associated with long-term side effects. It requires liver or kidney functioning. It can cause things like neuropathy or nerve damage to the feet. And so sometimes what we talk about doing is if the patient is not comfortable in coming off medications, we talk about maybe would it make sense to switch you over to another newer medication that has fewer long-term side effects, so you're still protected, but taking something that's a little bit safer, one of the newer meds. But it's an awesome question, and we struggle with this as physicians, and, you know, and it's an area where more research is needed. I tend to be more conservative, honestly, in my practice. My approach is sort of, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
We look to make sure that you haven't developed those long-term side effects. If we want to make sure you don't have brittle bones or osteoporosis, we want to make sure that your liver and kidneys look good, you don't have neuropathy, that your neurological exam is still normal. So I'm more conservative, but some of my colleagues are less so and, you know, would recommend a trial of coming off meds.
Lisa, thank you. Thank you for your time today. And really, thank you for everything you do for our community. And we really appreciate it. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Knopf, you could reach her at her office at 860-972-3600. Thanks again, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me, Tony. It was really fun having this talk.
Great fun. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board for us today. And as always, Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast anywhere where you get your podcasts, either from Apple Podcasts, Audacy.com, and download today's very informative program. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.